Welcome to the Forgiveness Lab podcast. In the Forgiveness Lab, we explore the practice of forgiveness as a power that can remove obstacles limiting love and well-being, lift burdens that crush people and distort our humanity, tend carefully to wounds of the soul, release us from bonds and constraints that have limited justice, reconciliation, and the practice of community. Liberate us to see and experience ourselves and those around us in new ways. Here we think it's helpful to imagine the practice of forgiveness as a range of imagination that breaks cycles of violence and diminishment and recognizes the image of God in all people. I am Scott Hutchinson, your host. Our producer and engineer is Jamie, quite reliant on him, and today I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Zach Ebrahim. Zach is a peace educator, an advocate for nonviolence, the author of the book, The Terrorist's Son, A Story of Choice. There's also a powerful TED Talk with that name that I would urge you to access. Zach is the founder of the Zach Ebrahim Project, which is dedicated to building stronger, safer communities by addressing the root causes of hate-related behaviors, such as income inequality, isolation, and trauma. Zach is the son of El Said Nosair, who in 1990 assassinated Rabbi Meir Kahane, the head of the Jewish Defense League, when Zach was 7. Later, while in prison, Zach's father participated in planning the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. We can imagine that led to tremendous repercussions for Zach and their family, displacement, concealing of identity, being bullied. Over time, though, Zach has made the choice for a life that promotes and embodies peace. And we want to talk about that today, too. As Zach has said to me, I am more than the terrorist's son. Zach, I've known you for about 9 years now, and I know you as a deep, gifted, compassionate, deeply textured human being. Welcome to the Forgiveness Lab.
Thank you so much. That was such a wonderful introduction. I really appreciate it. I'm just, so happy to finally get a chance to sit down and have this conversation.
Yeah, it's been a while coming. When I first met you, you and Sharon came to my congregation, and that was, believe it or not, over 9 years ago.
It's incredible. I can't believe it's been that long.
Yeah, I remember it well. And you came and shared your story with us. And I wonder if we could just talk a little bit. Can you tell me about, the power that you experience in sharing your story?
That's a great question. I've been sharing my story publicly for more than 10 years now. And it's interesting, as a speaker, I remember when I was first trying to decide whether or not this was something that I should do, whether it was something that would provide a positive message for other people. I thought back to an experience that I had when I was 16 years old. I was at the National Youth Convention that was taking place in Philadelphia at the time, in each respective city where the Republican and Democratic national conventions take place. They also hold these youth conventions. And so I was a part of that. I joined it through a college prep program. And I saw a young man, he was maybe in his mid-20s, get up on stage, and he started to share his life story. And he talked about growing up poor, being raised by a single mother, and being bullied a lot as a kid. And it was, for me at 16 years old, the first time in my life that I thought that there was another human being that understood what I had been through, being raised by a single mother, living in the instability after my father went to prison, the troubles that I had in school and in my neighborhoods. And I just remember this feeling kind of washing over me that I wasn't alone. And for years after that, I held on to that feeling, even during some of the most difficult experiences of my life. And the lesson that I took away from what he taught me was that things didn't always have to be this way, that change isn't just possible, it is inevitable. And that our actions, even at such a young age, do have agency. Mm. So when I was contemplating starting to speak, I remembered that experience, and I knew that, you know, how this young man's story affected me. And my hope was that if I could get up on stage and share my story in a way that made one other person in the crowd feel that there was someone who understood what they had been through, then that was enough. And, you know, I've been so fortunate over these many years to have been able to travel all over the world and share my story in front of all sorts of incredible people. So many memories pop into my head, you know, when you were telling me about my coming to St. Andrews to speak. You know, your congregation really is a very unique community. They were so welcoming. And honestly, I remember the experience so vividly. You know, a lot of times gigs can kind of melt together and you know, you don't remember exactly where you were when this experience happened or you know, or another. But I was really immediately struck by the welcoming nature of your congregation and you and just the, you know, the relationships that I got to build with, mm-hmm. with you and with you know, others in your community. I knew that it was special, and it really did stick into my mind. So as a speaker, my goal was always to try and make people feel like there was someone else who understood what they had been through. And over the years, what I talk about, you know, has evolved. I used to focus almost entirely on my father's experiences, and I slowly over time evolved into talking more about my personal experiences, the struggles mm-hmm. that I had outside of, you know, living in my father's shadow, dealing mm-hmm. with, you know, the bullying in school or domestic violence at home or, you know, mental health issues, talking about depression. My goal over time essentially became one where I wanted to create an environment that allowed people to feel safe to talk about the things that affected them.
Mm. Wow. Well, that's powerful. Well, so much of what you said there, you know, listening to someone else was a kind of gift that opened up some space and possibility for you. And you used the word agency, which was the word that was going through my head while you were speaking. But then how that offered encouragement and possibility for the sharing of your story and the kind of gifting of other people. I remember when you came to us, the gift of your testimony. You know, it would be hard for me to describe just an encounter with you. It would be good at the very least, even if it's on a video, for people to watch your TED talk and just have a sense of what it's like to see your face and what happens in your eyes and the sound of your voice. But there is a kind of giftedness there. And I can remember after you spoke to our congregation, we went up to Fellowship Hall and we sat there and talked further and how people wanted to make those connections and ask, you know, sensitive questions. You know, there's a kind of a, in a really positive way, a kind of viral nature to that.
Yeah, you know, I'm over the years, I've tried to kind of nail down what it is that's allowed me to just, you know, have an open communication with people. And I feel that, you know, having all of this time to look back on that, you know, perhaps in the way that I communicate it, it makes people feel comfortable to ask those personal questions, mm-hmm. or at the very least, I try and create an environment where people are comfortable to have questions and to ask questions. And for me, it always kind of came naturally to be as open as I could. And I hope that, you know, lended itself toward creating a better avenue or a better environment for communication.
I would call that a disarming presence.
That's a good way to describe it.
You have a disarming presence, which is good, you know, for a peacemaker and peace advocate.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
But, you know, when I, what we're involved in here, what I call the Forgiveness Lab, is an exploration of ways of relating to one another, kind of a way of being that we can share. And there's a lot of giving in it. I often call it giveness, you know. And I think that, you know, you communicate that when you speak, but also an openness to people. And I think that that's inviting. As you talked before, you also talked about how the way that you tell your story has changed. And it's my experience that, you know, I'd love to hear more from you about this. It's my experience that, especially in the healing of trauma, the telling of stories again and again and allowing the stories to take on new shape and to have new life and maybe pieces before that that have been lost joined back together, that there's some healing in that, a good deal of healing in
that. For me, you know, it's almost when I'm standing on stage sharing, you know, some of the worst experiences of my life, there's a sort of compartmentalization that goes on that almost allows me to separate that experience from my life. And again, you know, looking at it in hindsight over these many years, seeing the effect that sharing those stories can have on others takes some of the trauma of having been through those experiences away. You know, knowing that I can use something that was really hard for me to make things easier for others is, you know, in a way, it takes weight away from that, from that trauma. So, you know, I'd like to say that it could have been that it was the be all end all, and that it would have been the entire solution, but I'm sure my therapist would probably disagree with how much healing I may have gotten out of it. But it is the thing that gave me a sense of purpose in life. It is the thing that made me feel like I had something to give to others. And you know, having been able to talk to thousands and thousands of people over the years, that seems to be universally what we are all looking for, is this sense that we are important to others, that we provide something positive for others. And I just feel so grateful that this is what I have been able to do for a living for so long.
Mm-hmm. You talked before about the importance of hearing the testimony of another young person when you were in Philadelphia and that impact. Who are some of the other influences in your life, would you say, who have, you know, helped in, removing obstacles or lifting burdens, having that bigger story emerge?
Well, I would say Sharon, my best friend, is probably the person in my life who has had the most impact in that regard. She believed in me before I believed in myself. When we were contemplating, you know, my sharing my story, I knew that there was value in it, but I wasn't sure that I was capable of being the one to deliver that message. And, you know, she really believed in me. She was, as I tell people all the time, my courage before I had it. And it was her belief in me and my ability that ultimately allowed me to even, you know, try doing this. And it was her strength and her resolve that kept us going, you know, for a long time. But more abstractly speaking, I would say, you know, there were some pretty big influences in my life, both positive and negative. My ex-stepfather was an incredibly abusive man, both physically and emotionally. And these were during very formative years of my life, between, I would say, 14 and 18, where, you know, I'm trying to understand the world and the type of person that I want to be. And in a strange way, he was a really great example for me of what not to be. And, I, you know, the positive lessons in in positive stories were always important to me, but it seemed that finding the positive lessons in the really negative stories was much more important and more impactful. So I was, even at a young age, I was always looking for some kind of positive in the negative experiences. And in a way, it may have just been survival. My life was so turbulent, and I was just dealing with so many different kinds of problems that, you know, I probably had to find, I had to trick myself into finding the positive in some of these situations. But, you know, I would say that finding the positive in some of the worst experiences was really valuable to me. But, you know, on a more positive note, and I tell this story often, but Jon Stewart, who hosted The Daily Show for many years, in my youth, was really influential for me. He had a way of keeping me intellectually honest when I held on to many of the bigoted beliefs that I was taught in my youth, particularly with regard to gay people and, you know, sexuality and those kinds of things. It was kind of the first time I considered, you know, my own beliefs, the implications of my own beliefs. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important parts of all of this is interaction. So these were all wonderful concepts in my head, and I could feel my opinions sort of changing, but it really wasn't until I actually had interactions with those I was taught to hate that my beliefs kind of solidified, where people became humanized in my eyes. There were no longer these abstract stereotypes that I'd been taught from a very young age about evil people who wanted to make me evil. These were human beings who were, you know, standing in front of me and had emotion and whose eyes you had to look at when you were, frankly, being hateful toward them. So, but even in that, it wasn't just the interaction, but I'll tell you a story. When I was 17, I was working at Busch Gardens, an amusement park in Tampa, Florida, and I had the opportunity to interact with some of the gay performers at a show. And this young man, who was, you know, very open about his sexuality, I showed disdain toward him for what I perceived to be his choice. And in reaction to that, he showed me kindness. And it was so unexpected for me. You know, I was used to people returning the hatred that I conveyed toward them. I was used to them returning that hatred back toward me. But having someone react kindly made it extremely apparent that, you know, who I was in that situation, that I was being the bully, that I was causing someone pain. And because of my experiences being bullied in my youth, I could not escape the look in his eyes. I knew that what he'd felt, even through him showing me kindness, that I had felt that same feeling 1,000 times before. And I couldn't bring myself to make others feel that way. And so if there was something that I believed that caused others to feel the way I had been made to feel, well, then that was going to have to change. And, you know, I was fortunate that I had the right people in my life who supported those changes. In my TED talk, I talk about the story of my mother and me telling her how the way I saw the world was changing. And she said to me, "I'm tired of hating people." And that was such a powerful statement for me, because I knew just how much hatred had devastated her life, dealing with the fallout of my father's actions and everything that came with that. But more importantly than that, it was like she was giving me permission to go out and experience others without the prejudice that I'd been taught. And I would liken it to taking sunglasses off. I mean, the world was a brighter place. I didn't have to be afraid of the next person coming around the corner, you know, whether it was because of their sexuality or their gender or their race or whatever other arbitrary reason that I was taught to fear and to hate people, that I could just experience people one-on-one and determine whether they were a good or bad person based on the way they treated others was just one of the most valuable experiences to learn in my youth, that's for sure.
Wow, there's a lot there.
There is. I tend to ramble on and on, so if you ever need to cut me off, you go ahead.
I will confess to enjoying your rambling.
Thank you.
You know, it seems to me that the fellow at Busch Gardens, in a way, was his kindness was an expression of forgiveness. A break in the cycle that you were experiencing or that you were used to.
Absolutely. I had to find a different way. It was, in every sense of the word, overwhelming, you know, growing up like that. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that I knew at that age that my mind had been poisoned by the ideology in which I was raised. But it took me so much longer to realize just what other influences out there had poisoned my mind. I mean, you know, it's easy to, you know, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's easier to acknowledge the hateful nature of an ideology like my father's, because, you know, most people in society acknowledge that that is a hateful way to live life. But, you know, there were so many other influences, just, you know, growing up in America that I didn't even recognize about how we perceive each other based on the color of our skin or our gender. I mean, the way men perceive women. There were all of these different instances or influences that I realized existed that had been blind to me. And one of my goals always in speaking is to try and make people aware that those influences exist, that they don't sprout, you know, these opinions and ideas don't sprout naturally from your mind. They are bombarded at us from every direction, you know, culturally and societally. And so making people aware of why they believe the things they believe, I think is very important.
Yeah, there's a wake up there. As you said, to look at a rigid ideology, one can recognize the toxic nature of that, but that there are other poisonous things just in, you know, our cultural upbringing and assumptions and stereotypes and distorted roles that that we become enculturated with and imprisoned by, but that have really negative effects, obviously not just on us, but to the people with whom we relate.
Absolutely.
That's not just an individual passage, but that's kind of a communal passage that we can go through together. Especially when we recognize that we're on that path together or that we need to be.
Yes.
But hard for people to hear. I mean, you know, I guess hard for any of us to hear sometimes.
Well, you know, I think we, in a way, we try and, as human beings, we assume a lot because it allows us to feel that we have control, and no one likes to feel like they have no control. So when we're exposed to, you know, our influences, or when we see the way our influences affect us, in that way, you know, it can be scary, and you know, people have all kinds of reactions when it comes to fear. So I think communication is a big part of that. The way that you communicate, you know, what I think personally is something that is inside every single human being, this willingness to look the other way when a certain thing benefits us, or to maintain a system because it benefits us, and ignoring the way that it affects others. I think it's just naturally a human characteristic. So the more we acknowledge and understand that part of ourselves, I think that the better we can maybe control it. I don't know. Maybe that's just another way that I, as a human being, am fooling myself. I don't know, but I feel that at the very least, being aware, it begins with awareness. Mm-hmm.
So really, I guess it's important for us to create spaces with some level of safety so that we can have real, honest conversations with each other.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. As I said, that is one of my main goals in every event that I speak at, is to create an environment where people feel comfortable being wrong, to ask questions. And, one of the just recently, just a few months ago, before everything shut down, I was in Bangkok and a young woman came up to me after I spoke and said, one of the things that I really appreciated when someone asked you a question and you said, "I don't know." So many people feel that they have to have an answer for every single question. And I think part of a dialogue and certainly of honesty is admitting that you don't know a lot of times.
It would seem to me that needing to have an answer all the time, that's kind of a jail that we wind up living in.
Yes.
Yeah. I was really touched earlier when you talked about your mom and, her sharing her weariness in terms of, the impact of hatred and the devastation of it. And it felt like, her sharing that with you, and especially, as your mother, was a kind of release.
I certainly hope so. I hope that she was, she had many fewer options than I did. Many fewer. She had fewer options than I did as far as her ability to interact with other people. She was, married to a man who essentially never let her leave the house. So, in a way, I think perhaps she wanted to be able to live vicariously through my experiences. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that may have been a part of it too.
Mm-hmm. The power of her sharing that, and also, in a sense, to me, it sounded like of her blessing you.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely felt, I remember in the moment feeling, wow, okay, I have permission to do what is, to feel what I am feeling. And that was incredibly empowering.
We were talking about the impact of enculturation and the different things that can shape, our own behavior, and not always in a positive way. Tell us a little bit about the Zach Ebrahim Project and some of the initiatives in that area.
Sure. Well, Sharon and I began creating these programs for our nonprofit, and our goal always has been to try and provide a sense of, as we said, agency for the participants. So we have a few different projects. The first one, the Zach Ebrahim Project, is focused on, we're currently building a program that we can take into schools and into communities that help to facilitate communication between groups who don't have an opportunity to interact often or at all. We've found that particularly in the wake of extremist activity, in the wake of any sort of hate-related behavior that affects communities, that communication becomes very difficult between marginalized groups and the majority. So one of the things that I have learned over the years is just how important it is to keep avenues of communication open within communities. And so that is our goal, is just to help to facilitate communication between groups. One of the other programs is called the Art Box Program, and Sharon is heading up that initiative. And essentially we send boxes full of art supplies to people who have been either victimized or have had loved ones who have been affected by extremist attacks. And we allow them the opportunity to use these materials as a therapy. And we provide Skype lessons with art therapists who help them, you know, explore the materials in the box and using them just as a way of expressing themselves through a different medium. And our goal is to take a lot of these artwork and to have a mobile gallery that we can take either around the United States or around the world to share with others, to try and help facilitate the message that so many people who've been affected by these kinds of activities wish to. So they get to choose what message they want to share, and our goal is to spread that as far and wide as we can. Mm-hmm. And the last project that we created, which is very new, is a gardening project. And so again, we send a box of gardening supplies, seeds, soil, things like that, to people who would like to use gardening as a form of therapy. And the reason that we decided to do this was because I personally got into gardening some years ago, and I can't tell you how much it changed my life. I mean, mm-hmm. the amount of joy, the peace that I find when I'm in my garden, I don't even like tomatoes, but just smelling the tomato plants is one of my favorite things in the entire world.
Gosh.
Just the amount of, truly the peace that I feel.
I can testify to how important that is and how much that animates you or fills your spirit, because I've been with you face to face while you were talking about your garden.
Yeah, I get very excited about it. It's a thing that makes me feel more connected to the earth, which is not something I think that for a lot of people that connection has grown stronger as they get older. Certainly not in the time that we live in now. So, mm-hmm. Maintaining that connection with the earth, using something that is not just peaceful, but sustainable, and again, provides a sense of agency. I mean, there are few things that I enjoy more than walking out of my kitchen into my backyard, picking some vegetables off of the vine, and cooking them for dinner. The sense of accomplishment that I feel in that is mm-hmm. amazing. And I know that mm-hmm. I'm not hurting anyone else in doing that. That was one of the other things that I really struggled with as an adult, was trying to live my life in a way that didn't hurt others. And frankly, in the modern world, I feel that it's almost impossible to be a member of society and to not in some way harm others. My goal really has been to try and live my life in a way that that harms as few people as possible. And mm-hmm. gardening just created so many avenues for me in that regard. And my hope is that I can just pass along that love to other people.
Yeah, there's one invitation there, I think. Now, you just spoke very starkly about feeling as though really it's, I can't remember exactly, it's close to impossible to live in a way that will not hurt other people.
Yes.
Or, not that everything we do hurts other people, but to imagine that we can avoid that completely.
Yeah.
That's probably illusion. So, but here you're discussing, integrity and intention.
An implication.
Implication.
It's wonderful to believe things. Mm-hmm. But what are the implications of those beliefs? It's great to say, I believe that we shouldn't have war. Well, yeah, that's wonderful. I think most people would agree with you, but in what way do you live your life that helps to mitigate that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How do we interact with the people in the house that we live in with us, mm-hmm. with our neighbors, with our community members, with people on the other side of the planet? What are the implications of the way we live our lives, and how does it affect everyone else?
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, one of the great struggles of my adult life was coming to the realization that there is no, short of walking into the woods and mm-hmm. growing all of your own food and living in a hut, I'm really not sure that there is a way to live your life without harming anyone mm-hmm. else. So, you know, just doing my best to understand the effects and the mm-hmm. implications of my own beliefs.
And perhaps, you know, being open through new relationship to, and reflection to some transformational kind of power. Recognizing that we can't always engineer the outcomes that we would like, but that we can not only engage in transformative activity, but we can be open to being transformed on the way. That's
beautifully put.
Well, that's a spiritual journey, but one with great intention. And when I think about just listening to you, you know, engaging in or really seeking to engage in ways of living that, you know, again, that break those cycles of diminishment or injury, while at the same time also being immersed or invested in that which is life-giving. You know, when you were speaking earlier, one of the things I wanted to come back to, and I want to come back to now, is especially with your project, how do we really help people to listen to one another?
Well, that's a great question. I think you begin with, obviously, you need to create an environment where people feel that it's okay to share how they're feeling. You know, one of the ways that we've tried to facilitate that is simply by my coming in and sharing my story. So we have a community that sits down together, and we have the opportunity all together to sit in an environment where, you know, you can ask the questions that you'd like to ask without fear of repercussion or judgment, and using that as a starting point. Often the build up to implementing this program would be me coming into a community and sharing my story and trying to facilitate that environment of communication. And not to do it in the sense that, okay, we're all coming together to discuss a particular topic or subject. You know, we're not there to talk about politics or to exclude, you know, any subjects. We're simply, you know, the goal is always just to create an environment where people feel comfortable to share, to make themselves vulnerable. And that requires, I think, leaders who are willing to make themselves vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly I can't be the only one. And when I go into a community, that those are the people that I'm trying to target are the leaders who can make themselves vulnerable, who can create an environment where they can bring in members of their own congregations or communities and facilitate having other leaders come and bring their communities as well. Mm-hmm.
Mm. So in that vulnerability, there's the possibility for something new. And I know one of the things that that we engage in our trauma healing work, but that we've also done more and more in our congregation, is circle process, where we engage very intentionally in a restorative practice of circle process. And where we really practice listening to one another in terms of setting off the circle that we come into as a kind of a safe space for us to enter, mm-hmm. and having agreements about how we're going to relate to and listen to one another.
Yes.
And then we pass a talking piece so that only one person can speak at a time. And everybody else's role is to listen. And of course, that doesn't happen. Deep listening doesn't happen quickly. But the more that we practice those kinds of disciplines, over time, the voice in your head that is saying, you know, what you want to respond to the person with when they stop speaking, that tends to diminish. And you have more room just to listen to what somebody's saying to you that won't always require a verbal response.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the beautiful things about humanity is, you know, we may not
our natural reaction may not always be correct, but inside of us is the capability of you know, of change. And sometimes it takes having those kinds of rules in place so that we check ourselves internally. You know, I think that that's just it gives me a lot of hope.
Well, that's a good word, because the way that you've been speaking, you know, is very, very hopeful. And, you know, even there, when I'm talking about circle process, there's a good deal of hope invested in that. And I guess the belief or the recognition that, you know, we have these capabilities within us, you know, as human beings to honor the experiences of one another and to receive them. You know, we may not have had a lot of practice doing that, depending on what our, you know, life journey has entailed, or just, you know, the environments that we've been in, or the culture that we've grown up in, but we can learn how to do that. And it's the capacity is inside of us. I know that, you know, I've heard you talk about, you know, your experience of being bullied and how that, you know, as painful as that was over, you know, a long extended period of time, that you also have felt like that discovered or connected with or unearthed a sense of empathy in you for other people going through the same thing. Yeah.
Most certainly. You know, I had been bullied pretty much from kindergarten until you know, my junior year of high school, even before my father went to prison. You know, so this wasn't something that I necessarily attributed to my father going away or the instability in our household after he went to prison, but it was just something that I always dealt with. And you internalize that struggle, I think, for a lot of people. They blame themselves. They look to themselves and ask, well, why is it, what is it about me that is making people treat me this way? And one of the most profound moments in my life, I was in my 20s, my mid late 20s maybe, and my godmother, I was just relaying an experience, and my godmother said, you know that none of those things happened because of you, right? That was, it was because of who they were. It wasn't because of who you were. And my mind, I'd literally never considered that. You know, I always assumed that it was something inside of me that that caused people to treat me this way. And having that kind of shift in perspective, it frankly took so much of the burden of what I had experienced away when I realized that it wasn't necessarily because of who I am, but rather and almost certainly because of who the other person was that they treated me this way. You know, I tell that story about the young gay man and that experience of having that unexpected reaction from him. And truly, I think that that story signifies the empathy that I learned from bullying most succinctly. I mean, being able to read the emotion on his face and in his eyes when I treated him this way, it cut like a knife. I mean, I literally was looking in his eyes and thinking about the thousand times before that someone made me feel exactly how I was making him feel. And it didn't matter what I believed. It didn't matter what I thought of this person. The only thing that mattered to me then and in that moment was that he felt the way I had felt. And I had no control over that. And I hated that feeling, perhaps more than any other thing that I had ever experienced up until that point. You know, nothing else mattered. The only thing that mattered in that moment was that I not make him feel the way I had been made to feel. And, you know, it went to show me that, you know, this idea of, you know, what is good and what is bad, and the almost arbitrary ways that we as a society determine, you know, how we view others. It was such a stark example for me of how at the foundation of what I believed were just a bunch of lies, and that they were all based in fear. They're based in ignorance, which is ultimately based in fear. And I didn't want to be ignorant. I didn't want to be fearful anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a good friend of mine, Arno McCallis, is a former white supremacist, and he's chosen to use his life. He too is a storyteller, and he shares a lot of the personal experiences about his life. And he tells some really great stories about that unexpected reaction. You know, my showing hatred towards this young man and him reacting in a positive way to me. How it almost jolts your entire understanding of, you know, what it is you've been taught, of what you believe. And how exhausting it is living a life that is motivated by hatred or motivated by fear. It really takes an enormous amount of energy to maintain that feeling inside of yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you offered the vast majority of people who've been indoctrinated into hateful ideologies the opportunity to leave, they would do so in a heartbeat.
Wow.
You know, and that in and of itself is hopeful and you know, makes me believe in the efficacy of, you know, trying to counter violent extremism. Mm-hmm.
There's powerful insight there. And I also heard in what you said, you know, you were talking about coming to this realization that things that you had considered foundational, you called them lies. At the same time, it was almost as though you were driven to discovering a deeper foundation that was already there. Yes. That there was something underneath of all of that that was actually much more primary. And, you know, that's quite something too, because it didn't, the way you talked about that, it wasn't like these thoughts or these beliefs were in competition. It was that other people's humanity and your experiences drove you to a deeper place in yourself, you know, where you could experience recognition or, you know, through, who was that, your aunt or whoever who said to you, the godmother, yeah, your godmother, a kind of affirmation, mm-hmm. which is very, very powerful when we can affirm one another that way. Hey, I want to ask you something before we, you know, pull this to a close. This has been a very rich hour, Zach.
It's gone by very quickly.
Yes, it has.
I talk a lot. Gosh.
I like that. You know, you have on, you know, your site, and, you know, I've heard you talk about this. You say, you know, what my father did just about ruined my life, but it also made my life possible. You know, your reflection on the life you're living now. And I'm wondering, you know, what role does your dad have in your life now?
Huh. Well, that is a question that we probably should have asked at the beginning, because if we're trying to wrap things up, I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I didn't get the order right,
well, you know, that's such a difficult question for me to feel that I can give a good answer to.
Okay.
The honest truth is that I go back and forth between, you know, when you first asked me to do this podcast and you told me that it was called The Forgiveness Lab, it actually scared me a little bit, because I go back and forth between my, you know, this feeling that I've forgiven my father for what he had done to me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I can't forgive him for the way that his actions affected other people.
Right.
But the way in which his actions affected me in my life, I knew a long time ago that if I was ever going to do something positive with those negative experiences, that I was going to have to try and let go of that. Now, having that realization and making it so are two completely different things. And in a way, I feel that I was pretty successful in doing that. You know, in trying to find a positive way to use those negative experiences. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I still feel sometimes a resentment for the struggles that I had been through.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm feeling particularly down, and then that's part of struggling with things like depression. You're not always going to have the best thoughts, and part of my struggle and you know, part of understanding that about myself is understanding that, you know, just because you feel a certain way in the moment doesn't mean that that's, you know, truly how you feel, and mm-hmm. certainly that it's it doesn't mean that you're always going to feel that way,
right?
So I with my father, you know, it is complicated by the fact that I've tried to have communication with him over the years, and ultimately that communication was not very healthy. So, you know, I would say that I've forgiven my father certainly for the way his actions affected my life. But at the same time, when we have had communication, I've been frankly, you know, pretty disappointed in my perception of his progress in understanding how his actions affected our family. And, you know, I would have thought after all of these decades in prison that perhaps he would have come to the conclusion that he was a little more responsible than he has intimated to me when we've had communication. So that complicates things as far as how I feel.
Sure.
You know, but that's the struggle. That's part of life. You know, it's just understanding that that all of this, where we end up, is the important thing.
Well, that's a very honest answer.
It's very, you know, it's hard because of all of the things, of all the questions that people ask me, that is the one that I feel like I have the least control over. You know, I years ago, when my book first came out, I was in Greece doing a book tour, and I ask myself the same question that you ask me all the time about forgiveness with regard to my father. And the evening before I had this book event, I'm laying in my hotel room, and I thought to myself, "Wow, you know, I think I've finally gotten to a place where I'm comfortable never speaking to my father again." And this was really after months of back and forth. And really, you know, it was the first time in a long time that I felt like I had come to a conclusion. And the next evening, I'm at this book event, and someone asks me a question, and it was related to extremists in general and trying to understand, you know, their motivation and what it is that can cause someone to commit these acts of violence. And I realized just how much empathy I was trying to have for those people. And it struck me that I was not extending that same empathy toward my father. And in that instant, when I realized that, I thought, oh my God, now I have no idea again if I ever want to be in communication with my father or not. And I thought it was kind of comical that I was so sure of it the night before. I'm having all of these thoughts in my head, right, as I'm sitting there in this book event, that I was so sure yesterday that I was okay with never talking to my father again. And that in an instant, that could switch. You know, it's just...
Yeah.
It's a hard question. People want a good answer. They want a happy ending. And you know, that's not always necessarily possible, but we can, you know, we try, and you know, that's really all we can do.
Well, don't both of those feelings, or the multitude of feelings, don't they all belong? really.
Yes. Yeah. That's absolutely true. And I'm so glad that you bring that up, because I think that if there's anything that I understood from my father's actions, it's that people are capable of holding in what we perceive to be entirely opposing views inside of the same mind. So my father could show love to his children and show love to others, while at the same time exhibiting extraordinary hatred and violence toward others. So part of being human is having a whole bunch of contradicting ideas and thoughts in our heads. Mm-hmm. How we manage that, I think, is what makes us who we are.
Right. And emotions, which, as much as we want to control them, you know, they're our feelings. You know, they come from, you know, they can come from some real honest places. Yeah, you know, maybe I should have asked you that earlier, but well, I thank you for
joking. It's such a complicated question.
Oh, it is.
And I never feel like I give a very satisfying answer to it.
Would it help you at all if I said that, you know, that your answer is more than satisfying as far as I'm concerned?
Oh, it always helps me. Anytime you in particular share a positive opinion about something I'm saying, I always feel better about it.
Yeah, that seems to me to be so honest. You know, one of the things that you come back to all the time in you know, your storytelling and your testimony, you know, even as you like live into the future, is that you really highlight for anyone, you know, who's listening, the capacity to make choices. And, you know, they're not always, sometimes the choices that we're given or that we perceive aren't, you know, the greatest array of choices, you know, from one time to the next, but that we have, and again, you used the word early on, agency. And that, you know, just in what you've shared today, you know, the encouragement and the humanity of other people for you connected very deeply at an empathetic level, but also, you know, would encourage and awaken in you an experience of your own agency.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, I truly found my sense of purpose and, you know, the thing that makes me feel worthy in this. And, you know, my only hope is that I can do that for other people who, you know, feel or felt as lost as I do and did at times.
Well, Zach, believe me, you are a gift, my friend. And I really appreciate this time of us sharing, and I think people are really going to appreciate hearing this.
Well, I certainly hope so. I love every opportunity I have to have a conversation with you, whether it's recorded or not. You know, I always learn something, and frankly, I always come away with it feeling better than I did before. So thank you.
I'm glad for that. I have a feeling that when it comes to trauma healing and peace building, we're going to be working together in the future.
I certainly hope so, yes.
Well, take good care.
Yes. No, thank you both for having me. Thanks, Jimmy, for all the work you do. And Scott, you know, thanks again. Hopefully we can see each other in person soon.
Soon. Yeah, we have a place where we like to meet, so hopefully we can do that.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Many blessings.
Same to you both. Thank you so much.
Yeah.